This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, folks. Hope you're having a great Tuesday morning. We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so we're just going to jump right into it. But we're going to leave the back half of the 12 o'clock hour open for open lines. We'll go to the talk lines at that point in time. Every time you think that you have a better feeling or grasp as to what's going on politically in this country, there's always something that crops up that makes you wonder, what are people thinking? They must really believe that we are stupid. I've warned over and over and over again about soundbite politicians that are throwing things out there that don't really mean what they say. Because they believe that all we want to consume are snippets of information and that we will never look at the back channel to see what actually is going on and whether or not operationally what an individual talks about is even achievable. And they think that in today's world of fact check this, fact checker this, or go over there and find out what's going on, that they'll be able to do this without anybody ever finding out. It's crazy. At some point, it's going to come back and bite you. And look, both parties are guilty of it. Donald Trump, he's a master at misdirection, at saying things and exaggerating things. Everything he's ever accomplished was the greatest this or the greatest that. By now, I think people are actually immune to it. And those that run against him appropriately point out that they'd like to provide something different. But why don't they? It's not that hard. Just tell the truth. You don't have to puff. You don't have to engage in puffing. You don't have to engage in misdirection. You don't have to engage in deflection or denial or evasion. Just say it. Say what you mean. And in some cases, they don't talk to anybody, so they don't say much of anything. Well, it just so happens that the vice president, during her speech at the DNC convention the other day, said the following. So believe me, as president, I will go after the bad actors, and I will work to pass the first ever federal ban on price gouging on food. My plan will include new penalties for opportunistic companies that exploit crises and break the rules. Now, the fact of the matter is most states have these laws in place already. But this was like a big backfill for her about a policy that she was going to articulate in the 37 and a half minute speech, which the other day I said I thought was a good speech. I thought she delivered it in a masterful way. She made points that she had to make, right? Well, Politico, not a conservative rag by any stretch of the imagination, right, says that under pressure to defend Kamala Harris's grocery price gouging plan, some Democratic lawmakers are delivering a quiet message to anxious allies. Don't worry about the details. it's never going to pass Congress. The Washington Post says that Harris allies are arguing both publicly and privately that her plans have been taken out of context. Really? So what is it that she's trying to say? Well, these Democrat operatives are saying that she said that only for her constituency to understand that she was serious about this issue. Really? So that's where we're going to go now. Her own allies are saying she can't be serious about this price gouging thing. It'll never pass Congress. It's not appropriate for the federal government to be engaged in that silo. So basically, we are just now that this is just a ploy to convince people that she cares about fighting inflation. And she cares about you, the little people that are suffering. She understands. She's going to meet you where you are. Well, as I've been looking at what's going on with the vice president more and more, it's amazing how many folks embrace her on policy issues when she just simply says that it's worthy having a conversation about it. What does that mean? Is it on her radar? She may have a conversation. It doesn't provide any definitive position on anything, and people are willing to accept that as though it actually means something. I don't know of many politicians, when people ask a question about a particular subject matter, that said, that's not even worthy of a conversation. I'm not willing to talk to anybody about it and just lock everybody out. But it's amazing how we've embraced this worthy of having a conversation about it, as though that's a guarantee. It's a verbal contract, as though something is actually going to happen. I've learned now that when that is said, just throw that out, put that in file 13. It means nothing. It means nothing. All of the spin doctors are saying, well, that means that she's willing and open and receptive to hear your ideas. Well, most politicians are. But when you look at some of the things, other things that she says on some of these same issues, she's already embraced some notion of something that is potentially a problem. So, for example, now we understand that there's a major part of her party that's very upset with her position on Israel, right? Because she came out in a definitive way of saying what she said. She tried to play both sides with the Palestinian thing. They're unhappy. This is what happens with chameleons. You try to be all things to all people, and instead of only pissing off 50% of the electorate, you end up pissing off 100% of the electorate. Chameleons are never, ever successful in politics, because they ultimately don't stand for anything. They're proverbial, lick the finger, put it up in the air, see where the wind's blowing, and that's where I'm going. And they will reveal themselves. So this great policy statement that was made at the DNC the other day, we're finding out from her own Democratic allies that it actually means nothing. Don't worry about the details. None of this can pass. And it's so true, because it's bad policy. Democratic economists, Republican economists, independents and otherwise, all come together on this and say it is bad policy. So if that wasn't enough to think about, you know, how weird politics can be, that you would actually take up time during your DNC speech to say something just because you wanted people to think that you were caring about the plight that they find themselves in, and what you actually said doesn't mean anything. Even though you started the statement out that says, so believe me as president. Well, she's not president, I guess. She's vice president, so you don't have to believe anything she's saying at the present time, which might be safe too. Then we pivot to Mark Zuckerberg, who just writes a letter August 26th, yesterday, to the chairman of the Committee on the Judiciary. This letter is incredibly interesting. I'm going to read it because everyone needs to hear what he says. Dear Chairman Jordan, I appreciate the committee's interest in content moderation on online platforms. As you are aware, Meta has produced thousands of documents as part of your investigation and made a dozen employees available for transcribed interviews. Further to our cooperation with your investigation, I welcome the opportunity to share what I've taken away from this process. There's a lot of talk right now around how the U.S. government interacts with companies like Meta, and I want to be clear about our position. Our platforms are for everyone. We are about promoting speech and helping people connect in a safe and secure way. As part of this, we regularly hear from governments around the world and others with various concerns around public discourse and public safety. In 2021, senior officials from the Biden administration, including the White House, repeatedly pressured our teams for months to censor certain COVID-19 content, including humor and satire, and expressed a lot of frustration with our teams when we didn't agree. Ultimately, it was our decision whether or not to take content down, and we own our own decisions, including COVID-19-related changes we made to our enforcement in the wake of this pressure. I believe the government pressure was wrong, and I regret that we were not more outspoken about it. I also think we made some choices that, with the benefit of hindsight and new information, we wouldn't make today. Like I said to our teams at the time, I feel strongly that we should not compromise our content standards due to pressure from any administration in either direction, and we're ready to push back if something like this happens again. In a separate situation, the FBI warned us about a potential Russian disinformation operation about the Biden family and Burisma in the lead up to the 2020 election. That fall, when we saw a New York Post story reporting on corruption allegations involving then Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's family, we sent that story to fact checkers for review and temporarily demoted it while waiting for a reply. It's since been made clear that the reporting was not Russian disinformation, and in retrospect, we shouldn't have demoted the story. We changed our policies and our processes to make sure this doesn't happen again. For instance, we no longer temporarily demote things in the U.S. while waiting for fact checkers. Apart from content moderation, I want to address the contributions I made during the last presidential cycle to support electoral infrastructure. The idea here was to make sure local election jurisdictions across the country had the resources they needed to help people vote safely during a global pandemic. I made these contributions through the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative. They were designed to be nonpartisan, spread across urban, rural, and suburban communities. Still, despite the analyses I've seen showing otherwise, I know that some people believe this work benefited one party over the other. My goal is to be neutral and not play a role one way or another, or to even appear to be playing a role. So I don't plan on making a similar contribution this cycle. You know what's weird about when you think about politics is everyone denied that all of this was done. No one was really putting pressure on Meta, or otherwise known as Facebook. Why would anyone think that that would happen? No, that cannot be true. We are the purveyors of free speech. We believe in free speech. We would never do something like that. Interesting about this, this is one of the few times that a head of an organization of a far-reaching service that is being provided by Meta comes to the forefront and says, no, the administration actually tried to move us in one direction or the other. They were basically concerned, is what he's saying, is that their messaging wasn't going to be able to convince the public of much of anything. He goes on to say that in hindsight, now that he has seen the evidence that some of the same folks that he throttled down on relative to their content were absolutely 100% right. This is dangerous. Very dangerous. That we would go to this extent to mislead the public, even in the aftermath of this happening, and denying that this went on. This letter will be remembered for generations to come. That this administration, in spite of their repeated denials, in spite of misleading, in spite of deflection, in spite of denial, and in spite of evasion, and in counterattacking everyone that ever brought this issue up, has now been called out by the victim, the recipient of the heavy-handed approach by this administration to stymie and squelch speech. All the while thinking that they're working for the greater good, as they see it. Kind of very subjective, right? Not really objective in any way, shape, or form. It's going to be interesting to see how the Democrats now spin this issue. The hand has been caught in the proverbial cookie jar. And the interesting thing about the Biden story is that that was right on the cusp of the election. They went to lengths to mislead, deflect, deny, and evade the truth from you knowing the truth. And to this day, they still deny. They still deny. The dozens of intelligence officials signing a letter. They still believe that was Russian disinformation to start with, in spite of the mounting evidence to suggest otherwise, that it politically came right out of the White House. So we just continue to mislead. The vice president's going to mislead right now, the president, President Biden's administration. And then, of course, what happens next, which is no big surprise. First, there's a big story about whether or not stolen valor with Tim Walz. I don't know what the truth is in that case. You know, it could be that there was a mistake. I'm not sure. Willing actually to give him the benefit of the doubt. But where I'm not willing to give him the benefit of the doubt is when you go back to his 06 campaign, Walz, in his campaign materials, boasted that in 1993, he was named the Outstanding Young Nebraskan by the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce for his service in education, military, and small business communities. Well, it turns out that the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce says, hold on. Why are you saying this? We have no record of ever giving you an award in 1993 for being the Outstanding Young Nebraskan by the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce. They reviewed their records. They had people that worked there for 20 to 30 years that went back. And nowhere in the archives of the Nebraska Chamber of Commerce can they find a scintilla of evidence to suggest that he was ever recognized. Now, the irony here, and we don't believe in coincidences here on a Newell Norman show, is that his opponent at that point in time was being supported by the Chamber of Commerce in that election. Go figure. Well, he didn't stop there, and it seems as though they've uncovered another lie by Tim Walz about his accomplishments. He's made several claims that as a former high school teacher, he won either one or two times the Minnesota Teacher of the Year awards. It turns out now, after folks are fact-checking him, he says that he lists three teaching awards, and he didn't receive any of them. And it's like, here we go again. What are we doing? And in many cases, the puffing stories that were told about the familial history of Joe Biden are not nearly as egregious as what we're doing here. We're actually fabricating that we were the recipient of awards. Now, one has to ask, why would you do that? Do you really believe at the end of the day, when you're running for public office because you received a Teacher of the Year award, that that's going to end up moving somebody one way or the other? Or is it just that your resume was devoid of anything meaningful at that point in time, so you had to, you know, engage in puffing and boast it up or whatever, not thinking that in the end somebody was going to catch you and say, what are you talking about? You never received this award. So again, what we're finding out about politics is at first blush, believe nothing. Don't believe much of anything that any of these people have to say. Because you don't know whether or not this is truthful or not. Even the simplistic things of a de minimis award and recognition as one runs for public office, we choose to mislead. This is where we find ourselves in politics today. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Andrea Gallo, who just authored an article called You Blew It, DCFS to Blame for Louisiana Teens Botched Adoption, Potential Mom Says. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's certainly a pleasure. I just wanted, for the sake of everyone knowing, I know a little bit about adoptions because I am the father of adopted children. And when I read your story from an adoptive parent and being a prospective adoptive parent twice, it was really heart-wrenching, the story that you tell about Angel, not to mention the child itself, herself. I had kind of chills going down my spine, some of it anger and some of it shock and just raw emotion.
Sure. It's a really upsetting tale of what happened. This is a 16-year-old who's been in foster care since she was 10 years old. She's currently living in a group home, which is less than ideal circumstances. This was the first person who had ever really inquired about adopting her, and yet the whole thing fell apart. And I think everybody involved is upset about the outcome.
So it seems to me the sense that I got and is that some of these folks involved in this process, although maybe well-intentioned, but fall prey to the path of least resistance. Did you get that sense?
Well, I think that everybody comes at this with a different perspective, but, you know, the biggest concern of this prospective adoptive mother was just being able to review the medical records of this teenager before potentially taking her into her home. You know, she wanted to make sure that she was prepared for whatever sort of diagnoses the teen might have. And DCFS refused to let her do that. They would not give her those medical records. And whenever I asked them if they could point to a policy or anything in their handbook that would explain why they wouldn't give that information, they did not answer that question, nor did they answer any questions for the story. So we're kind of left guessing why they made the decisions that they made.
But it was evident that they really, in some respect, were not working in the best interests of the child in fully exploring the possibility of this potential adoption, right?
I think that probably depends on who you talk to, but the prospective adoptive mother certainly has that view. And I think it's important to point out as well that most children in foster care, if their parental rights have been terminated and if there's no hope of reconciliation with their own families, their sort of goal in foster care is to be adopted by another family. And after this whole ordeal fell apart, this particular teenager's goal was changed to permanent foster care. So it doesn't seem like the state made a lot of effort at the beginning to try to find a prospective adoptive family for her. Whenever one appeared, the whole thing, you know, went sideways. And now the state no longer has to make any sort of efforts to find a family for her because her goal is no longer adoption.
Obviously, a prospective adoptive parent or parents have a desire to understand the breadth and depth and level of trauma that a kid has experienced, especially in the foster care program. As one of the experts that you talked to mentioned, that this child had been uprooted 12 different times in foster care. And obviously, the science shows that And the mental health science shows that this is a significant amount of trauma for a young kid. You would think that experts in the field would recognize that and possibly have an intermediary, a curator, or someone to manage the back and forth flow of information relative to this. The child was 16 years old. The child, I mean, could be held accountable for all kinds of things under the criminal code in the state of Louisiana, but it's almost as if they have these absolutes that until the child reaches a certain age, they're not able to waive some of those provisions, which just seems a little archaic to me in many respects.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that we hear often about children in foster care is that they are essentially voiceless. They lack agency over themselves and their own lives. And I think that's a good example of this. Every child in foster care is supposed to have a lawyer who handles their case. But in this particular case, where a lawyer could have been extremely helpful and intervened and tried to pry open some of these records, the state's children's ombudsman, Kathleen Ritchie, said she could never reach the lawyer for this teenager. I personally could never reach the lawyer for the teenager either. So that's a concern. Also, like you were saying, she's 16 years old. And at 16, the lawyers who I spoke to for the story said that she should have some ability to say who she wants to share her medical records with. But it doesn't necessarily seem like that happened in this case. And one other concern with the medical records of a lot of teens in foster care is just that they get uprooted so much, they go through so much trauma, and they're evaluated by so many different providers that they're often filled with any number of diagnoses that turn out not to be accurate, especially once they are eventually in a more stable or loving environment. You know, some of it is just environmental and them doing what they need to do to survive in those circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about someone 16 years old being uprooted 12 times, you know, one thing about child rearing is you try to establish consistencies, right? I mean, obviously there were none here. There's no telling what story that child told at one point in time versus another, based on the quality of care, based on whether or not there was a loving atmosphere, a caring atmosphere. We all know, and you guys have written many times about some of the horrific stories that we've seen in foster care over the years. And as one of the folks that you interviewed for this story, Jennifer Rodriguez, who herself is involved in works in this system, not inside but outside, she was a foster teen herself. So she knows firsthand what actually goes on there, right?
Yeah, Jennifer is particularly interesting because she can speak on this from firsthand experience. She was in foster care most of her life. She cycled through group homes and juvenile justice centers and all sorts of places. And she had a lot of interesting things to say about, you know, just how detrimental it is to a teenager every time you are disrupting any sort of placement they've had, any sort of bond or attachment that they've formed. And Jennifer also kind of explained to me just how difficult life can be when you're living in a group home. She said, for example, that if she wanted to go to a 7-Eleven and get a Slurpee on the weekend, she would have to put in an outing request a week ahead of time to do something like that. You know, normal teenagers have the ability to kind of go places, see their friends, have a little bit of freedom and independence. And that's something that teenagers in group homes often don't have. And Jennifer also had been diagnosed with any sort of all kinds of psychiatric diagnoses when she was a teenager in foster care. And whenever she got older and aged out of the system, she told me she could no longer afford her medications. So she got off of all of them and suddenly realized that she felt so much better and she didn't actually need any of them to begin with. So I think that she kind of can really represent the tale of some of the perils of foster care, especially group homes for teenagers. But the good news is that she came out on the other side and she's doing great. And she now leads an advocacy group to help these sort of teenagers. And so hopefully we'll see the same for teenagers in foster care in Louisiana.
You know, the heart-wrenching part of the story, Andrea, was, you know, Angel, the prospective adoptive mother, having visited with the child. They seem to have connected on so many different fronts, stayed in contact with them all the while trying to work through this lengthy process with a lot of high hurdles to get over. And in the end, it seems as though, and I don't know whose side of this story is true, someone ultimately articulate or communicates with the child that Angel said some not nice things about the prospective adoptive child. And Angel says that's not true. She would never do that. And as you know, as I was reading what you wrote about your interviews with Angel, I had the feeling, I didn't get that sense. I mean, she's still trying to stay in contact with her and still wants to provide something some way, somehow. And now it's just all ended. And I mean, it's just tragic. Separate and apart from the adoption, I think Angel would have stayed involved in her life in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, it's evident to me, having talked to her quite a bit over the course of the past several weeks reporting this story, that she cares very, very deeply about this teenager. She really, you know, she thinks about her constantly, despite all of this kind of happening about a year ago at this point. She, you know, talked about different schools that she could go to in the Hudson Valley and friends that she would want to introduce to her up there. And, you know, she made a lot of effort to try to reach family members of this teenager in Louisiana in hopes of her having some semblance of family connections down here. She really, really, you know, thinks a lot about the teen. And, you know, this certainly is not the outcome that she would have wanted. And I think she still has some hope, though maybe not a lot of it, that one day the two of them will be able to have a relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to me, as I think back as an adoptive parent, she did all of the things that you would do in the due diligence to make sure that you're able to deliver what you're supposed to deliver, right? I mean, what you're supposed to do, and whether there sometimes there could be challenges that you're unaware of. As long as you're aware of it and you self-reflect and decide one way or another whether or not you're the one that can be there for that child. It's just, and you know, and I think one of the last communications that Angel had with her is she wrote, "You and I are both victims of a crappy system." And I don't know that based on your story, I don't know that I couldn't have said it any better. Your thoughts?
Right. I think that the point that you make about trying to have as much information on the front end going in is a really important one, because this is something that we try to talk to experts and lawyers who work on adoptions about. And there are some really horrible, tragic stories about what happens with families who do adopt a child without necessarily knowing what they've been through. Kathleen Ritchie, who I mentioned earlier, is the children's ombudsman. Mm-hmm. She was a juvenile court judge in Baton Rouge for a very long time, and she remembered seeing cases on the bench where families would adopt a child and then essentially return them to custody of the state, not because they didn't love them or, you know, they developed problems, but because once they adopted them, these families were shocked by the amount of trauma that these children had gone through, the amount of behaviors and acting out that led to, and they felt totally unequipped to handle them and take care of them. So, you know, I think a lot of people would argue that you need to know what you're getting into eyes wide open whenever you adopt a child. And like you're saying, that can help prepare you to take care of them and to get them whatever sort of help they might need.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, ours were at birth, so it was very different. But having worked in that process, and my wife as a lawyer, having handled adoptions for 20-30 years, you hear these stories and you understand the nuances. And it just seemed here that we were almost devoid of understanding the nuances. And it should be the folks that have this institutional experience should know better. It just seemed like, you know, wasn't that important. And it's a shame. I hope I'm not mischaracterizing this, but it's what it felt like. I don't know. It's just, and I don't know where we go from here. I mean, hopefully there's a lesson learned from here and the system can be improved.
And I think particularly for this teenager who is now, you know, very close to aging out of the foster mm-hmm. care system, yeah, it's especially concerning that we hope she will find a sort of landing pad once she's on her own. But yeah, it's definitely tragic and heartbreaking.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this story with us, Andrea Gallo, a writer for The Advocate. We truly appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. So I got a couple of texts saying that they didn't quite understand how this story unwound. So Miss Angel saw on an adoption website a teenage foster child in Louisiana that stood out to her. The child was 15 years old. She gave some background information about her, so she started to inquire with Louisiana's Department of Children and Family Services. And she was working with the same organization in New York where she lived in the Hudson Valley. And these interstate adoptions are not unusual, but they do require some additional steps in order to successfully adopt. So she asked to see medical records to confirm some of what she was told originally about certain diagnoses before she wanted to start talking to the teen to see whether or not this was something that, you know, that they were going to work out together. She got some preliminary information. She ended up meeting with their prospective adoptive child. They hit it off. They were communicating for a long time. And they were constantly, Miss Angel was constantly asking for more of the records and basically was getting stonewalled, and the agency wouldn't provide the records. The folks that were guiding Miss Angel back in New York were recommending, don't do anything unless you get the full medical record so that you understand, because sometimes there are things that you, it's going to be a significant financial burden. Some people are willing to take it on. Some are, don't have the capacity to do so. And you see this frequently in the adoption world. Well, they were stonewalling, and it never got anywhere. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is you had a prospective adoptive mother out there who was really pushing and wanted this to happen and wanted it to succeed, and just the bureaucracy wore this thing down. And then ultimately there were some additional medical records that were given, which were in complete total conflict to the ones that were, had been previously provided. So Miss Angel started pushing a little harder to get these records and never did quite get it. And in the interim, there was a lot of communications that had gone on between the child to be adopted and the prospective adoptive mother. And they were feeling a lot closer and better about things moving along, very excited, talking about schools that she could attend in the Hudson Valley and things of that nature. And then this whole thing went haywire over these records and the inability of the agency to. So I said, appoint a curator, get the lawyer involved as the go-between, make sure that all the necessary precautions so that you're not violating people's HIPAA rights or otherwise here. But this is part of the process. There's nothing new here. This is not rocket science. Everybody understands that this is part of the due diligence that's done for the benefit of both sides of this equation. And it's a shame because there are not many people that want to adopt a 16-year-old. They're few and far between. And when you have these opportunities come up, and as Andrea put forth in her story, it was clear to everybody that Miss Angel may truly have been an angel and was trying to do the right thing, and just the whole thing went astray, so much so that the prospective adoptive child kind of just shut it down and didn't want to talk about it any longer, and obviously felt yet again, maybe for the 13th time, that something, the rug had been pulled out from under her. So that's the short story of it. It's a lot longer, but that puts it in context. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with the executive director of the 18th Ward, Janicia Neely, as well as Lowry Cruz, the founder and CEO of the 18th Ward, and Bernie Pensinot, political analyst.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
So I got a couple of texts saying that they didn't quite understand how this story unwound. So Miss Angel saw on an adoption website a teenage foster child in Louisiana that stood out to her. The child was 15 years old. She gave some background information about her, so she started to inquire with Louisiana's Department of Children and Family Services. And she was working with the same organization in New York where she lived in the Hudson Valley. And these interstate adoptions are not unusual, but they do require some additional steps in order to successfully adopt. So she asked to see medical records to confirm some of what she was told originally about certain diagnoses before she wanted to start talking to the teen to see whether or not this was something that, you know, that they were going to work out together. She got some preliminary information. She ended up meeting with their prospective adoptive child. They hit it off. They were communicating for a long time. And they were constantly, Miss Angel was constantly asking for more of the records and basically was getting stonewalled. And the agency wouldn't provide the records. The folks that were guiding Miss Angel back in New York were recommending, don't do anything unless you get the full medical record so that you understand, because sometimes there are things that you, it's going to be a significant financial burden. Some people are willing to take it on. Some are, don't have the capacity to do so. And you see this frequently in the adoption world. Well, they were stonewalling, stonewalling, stonewalling. It never got anywhere. And, you know, and the fact of the matter is you had a prospective adoptive mother out there who was really pushing and wanted this to happen and wanted it to succeed. And just the bureaucracy wore this thing down. And then ultimately there were some additional medical records that were given, which were in complete total conflict to the ones that were, had been previously provided. So Miss Angel started pushing a little harder to get these records and never did quite get it. And in the interim, there was a lot of communications that had gone on between the child to be adopted and the prospective adoptive mother. And they were feeling a lot closer and better about things moving along, very excited, talking about schools that she could attend in the Hudson Valley and things of that nature. And then this whole thing went haywire over these records and the inability of the agency to. So I said, appoint a curator, get the lawyer involved as the go-between, make sure that all the necessary precautions so that you're not violating people's HIPAA rights or otherwise here. But this is part of the process. There's nothing new here. This is not rocket science. Everybody understands that this is part of the due diligence that's done for the benefit of both sides of this equation. And it's a shame because there are not many people that want to adopt a 16-year-old. They're few and far between. And when you have these opportunities come up, and as Andrea put forth in her story, it was clear to everybody that Miss Angel may truly have been an angel and was trying to do the right thing, and just the whole thing went astray, so much so that the prospective adoptive child kind of just shut it down and didn't want to talk about it any longer, and obviously felt yet again, maybe for the 13th time, that the rug had been pulled out from under her. So that's the short story of it. It's a lot longer, but that puts it in context. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we'll visit with the executive director of the 18th Ward, Janicia Neely, as well as Lowry Cruz, the founder and CEO of the 18th Ward, and Bernie Pensinot, political analyst.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Come join me, Andrew Filippone.
And me, Patrick Peterson, three-time NFL All-Pro cornerback on First and Pod for premier NFL coverage and conversations.
Our motto on the podcast is every team, every week, and we don't play favorites. Every episode, you get a glimpse of the entire National Football League with First and Pod. Follow and listen to First and Pod on Mondays and Fridays on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.